Hello and welcome to the Alcohol Problem Podcast. I'm Dr. James Morris, an alcohol researcher interested in harmful drinking and addiction issues. This stems in part from my own experiences, so the show aims to explore a range of lived and academic perspectives relating to the question of what really is an alcohol problem? In this episode, I talk to Dr. Wendy Dossett, an Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Chester, about spirituality and recovery. This is discussed in the context of Alcoholics Anonymous, as well as spirituality and Buddhist-orientated recovery groups. We also talk about stigma, language, labelling, and other issues relating to recovery and spirituality. Thanks so much for joining me, Wendy. This is a subject that I'm really interested in, and I'm sure lots of listeners will be as well. But could you tell me, in a general sense, how you see spirituality in the context of recovery?
Sure, James. Thanks for having me on. I think there's two ways of looking at that question. There's a historical way of looking at it, thinking about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, which really is the organisation that introduced the idea of spirituality into recovery. But there's also looking at the kind of experience of addiction itself and how people experience that as a state of powerlessness over a substance, and how the search for a higher power to enable them to recover is a part of that.
I mean, AA is, or Alcoholics Anonymous, there are so many myths about it, aren't there? And there's so much speculation. My view is always that probably no two meetings are the same. And so, yeah, just tell us a bit more about AA and spirituality within that.
So AA started in the 1930s in post-prohibition America. So its language is very much linked to that context. And the experience of the early members of AA was that they felt that they didn't have the willpower themselves to establish abstinence and recovery from addiction. So therefore, a higher power would be necessary. And for them at that time, it was obvious that that higher power would be, you know, the God of Christianity. The Protestant context in which they lived and thought very much kind of dictated that. So that's the heritage of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I find interesting in my research is to explore ways in which contemporary members of AA who are not in that, you know, 1930s American context interpret that idea. We're in a society that has, to a certain extent, become secularized. So what does that concept of higher power mean to contemporary members of AA? Do they warm to that concept? Do they interpret it in different ways? What influences their concept of higher power? And I've discovered there's huge diversity. So what you say about no two meetings are ever the same, I think that's true, but also no two concepts of higher power are ever the same.
Yeah, that's super interesting, because there's a few sayings that are perhaps not part of the 12 steps or the big book that are very commonly used. And I think, does the idea of you interpret the higher power in your own way is a really important thing, I think, particularly in contemporary terms. Is that right? And if so, what are the common ways that people tend to do it?
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly central to AA. I think people have a misconception that AA tells people they must believe in this, that and the other. But in fact, people are invited to kind of engage with that concept of higher power in ways that suit them. So the vast majority of the people that I've interviewed in my research reject the idea that there's anything religious about their concept of higher power. For many of them, it is simply the group and the power of friendship that they experience in AA meetings. So there's this phrase that's often used, group of drunks, G-O-D. So it's the idea of a higher power is not a supernatural being, but it's the power of identification. It's the power of mutual support and encouragement. It's that experience of coming out of shame and denial and being able to live a new life. So the idea of higher power, you know, is interpreted in so many ways. For example, people often use the kind of metaphor, it's like the Force in Star Wars, or people want to identify nature as their higher power, as a kind of source of meditation or seeing themselves in a wider context as part of the universe. All kinds of different ideas. What one participant talked about her cat as her higher power. And I think I'm quite interested in how easily we stigmatize people for their beliefs. But for that participant, she was casting around for an idea of unconditional love in her life. And therefore she focused naturally on the one sentient being in her life that offered her unconditional love. And that made a great difference to her. We also found that people's ideas of higher power changed over time during their life in recovery. So they might have a very kind of definite idea of a higher power that was enabling them to stay sober in the early days. And that might change over time, become less personal, more abstract over years in recovery. But I think what's most interesting is that people do very, very different things with this idea. So there is no, you must believe this or you must believe that. The AA environment is kind of a workshop in which people work out their own idea of a higher power. Everybody that we interviewed certainly said that a higher power was essential to their recovery, and their experience of addiction was an experience of powerlessness. So exerting their willpower again and again over the substance and failing to get any purchase on it. So it was an experience of despair of personal willpower and the need for a higher power. But for some people, that higher power was simply a better version of themselves. It wasn't necessarily something outside of themselves. It was just drawing on a power that they felt was untapped within them.
That's so interesting. And I really like the example of the cat, because I think in many ways for me, it's the idea of social connection and meaning.
Sure.
Again, in whichever way you kind of want to interpret that. But, I think that to me is my sort of understanding of spirituality, is that there being something more than science and physics, that as humans, we are in need of something more than just being able to understand everything in terms of mathematics or the rules of scientific positivism or whatever, that those social connections and meanings are so important. And that's, I think, in the sort of broader recovery literature, that this whole kind of process of social identity change, removing yourself from situations and peers where drug or alcohol use is expected, to one in which it's supported and encouraged not to use or drink. Mm. And with that comes a whole set of different meanings and social connections. Mm. And that's in a way the sort of motivation, but the idea of spirituality as a way of finding meaning in your life, however you interpret that or however that's going to work for you. Is that on the right lines, would you say?
Sure. I mean, you're talking about what clinicians would call adaptive social networks, aren't you? Yeah, I mean, you can talk about it in that clinical way, or members of 12-step fellowships would talk about it in terms of identification, spirituality, finding meaning. For sure, they're just two different ways of talking about the same experience. John Kelly, the Harvard academic who studies the mechanisms of behavioral change in Alcoholics Anonymous, notes that it's people taking responsibility, getting involved in service, becoming meaningful members of a community where often they have been ostracized from many other communities on the basis of, their addictive behaviors. They find a place, they find belonging, they find meaning, they take responsibility, they discover that the awful things that they feel that they have done are the very things that enable them to connect with others in a non-judgmental way. And as a community, members of AA are able to help each other to address shame and guilt and to rebuild lives as a consequence. And it's certainly possible to call that spirituality. It's possible to use clinical language as well, but it's the same phenomenon that's happening.
I'm always kind of talking about the paradigms of alcohol problems. And I think because of that history, and particularly in terms of the disease model, that's
a way that a lot of people make sense of alcohol problems is literally its sort of embodiment as a disease. And yeah, I suppose it's the language and understandings that people have or are drawn to in their different experiences may mean that often people are talking about the same thing, but in very different ways. So yeah, I'm always trying to reflect on my own perhaps clinical or more public health lens in which I see things.
Sure.
Can you talk a bit more about that then in terms of the way things like disease or other aspects of AA or spirituality are interpreted?
Yeah, sure. So I don't think the members of AA that I've spoken to, although they talk about what they've experienced in addiction as an illness, most of the people that we've spoken to wouldn't necessarily mean that in clinical terms as a brain disease, the kinds of discussions that are had in some public health environments. What they mean is they experienced it as something they literally couldn't help. And I think that's really important, that they're not talking in clinical terms. They're not entering a debate about whether their condition is technically a disease or not. They're talking about a first-person experience of being wholly unable, you know, wanting very much to behave differently, but being wholly unable to do that. And then when they join a community which uses that language of illness, that's a powerful way to overcome shame, and people realize that what was going on, you know, they were powerless over that. That doesn't mean they can't become accountable for it. And of course, the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about becoming accountable. But it's a very powerful way of dealing with shame. And shame's a dangerous thing in addiction, because you know, members of Alcoholics Anonymous would say, you know, it's shame that keeps them drinking. So thinking of it in a functional way, calling the problem an illness, at least in this context, is a way that people can overcome shame. Now, I know your work, James, has been absolutely fantastic in addressing wider stigma issues and how stigma prevents people from seeking help. And of course, calling people alcoholics, or, you know, the way that term disease is used sometimes to demean or belittle or stigmatize people, that can be really problematic. But, you know, especially in a kind of public discourse sense, but internally within the 12-step fellowships, that language, it's not used in a professional sense. It's used as a way to help people to manage their shame enough to be able to bring about the changes that the 12-step program kind of enables them to do. So,
yeah, that's super important. I was going to come on to that in the sense that, yeah, sort of self-identifying and making sense of something and putting a name on something that, you know, addiction, again, the sort of academic or public debates are maybe very circular in some ways because it's such a complex and uniquely personal experience that there isn't perhaps a way of defining it in a way that's going to make sense for everybody. So that personal sense-making process is obviously so important, and people are going to just try and make sense of it in the way that works for them. And obviously, that is such an important part of AA. I mean, one of my favourite papers is the Hill and Leeming paper, where they talk about how people kind of wrestle with the alcoholic identity. But for a lot of people, it's always going to be an important part of putting a name on something and maybe making sense of that process. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right that it's really important to distinguish and recognise that for many people, that's a really important part of the process. Yeah, I suppose what I'm interested in is the way in which maybe I might say that terminology or disease labeling kind of maybe spills over into other discourses where it's perhaps, like you say, harmful in terms of stigmering or othering other people. And particularly in the way that I think heavy drinkers who don't self-identify maybe are drawn to the idea of it being a disease, because that means they'll place themselves on the non-disease side of this false binary. So I'm certainly, it's great that you can articulate so well how for a lot of people it is so important to be able to use that label, and it may be done in a metaphorical or very personal way, you know, or just within the confines of a meeting and not ever used elsewhere.
I think that's right. I think also, you know, when people self-identify as alcoholic in an AA meeting, what they're doing, that's a move of humility, you know, which would be thought of as a spiritual virtue. It's also a move of equality. So there's no kind of social hierarchy as there is in the outside world within an AA meeting. So it's a kind of statement of solidarity, equality, humility. Yeah, and people say that it's an element of their identity that they need to remember, and it's helpful to use that term about themselves to remember, you know, oh yes, I am an alcoholic, therefore I can't drink safely. People find that a useful thing to say, but it's much more than that. It's got these, you know, some might say spiritual characteristics. So, you know, I do think it's unfortunate when that does spill out into public discourse. I mean, I'm listening with great interest to the current storyline on The Archers on Radio 4, where Alice, I don't know if you listen to it, but Alice is...
I don't know.
So she's there. They're using that term alcoholic in very definite terms, and this is an environment where, you know, she's not going to meetings or anything. She's just being labelled as an alcoholic by her partner, as if that was a meaningful label. And I think it is thought to be a meaningful label in a lot of wider discourse. And, you know, I think your work in pushing back against that is so important. But at the same time, you know, within the context of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's really interesting to know what's going on there when people do identify in that way. And it is very important to people to be free to identify in that way.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the kind of anti-stigma effort needs to be kind of very directed in that sense, that it doesn't take away people's right to first person identify in that way, if that feels right to them and important to them.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really to not push that label onto someone else. I think, you know, just the example you're giving there in The Archers, you know, I think for a lot of people, when they view someone else as having an alcohol problem, they might kind of mistakenly assume that the only necessary change is for them just to admit that they are an alcoholic, and then that would somehow unlock the recovery. Whereas we've kind of touched on that it's more that's for some people part of the process of recovery, rather than it's just the simple attaching or recognizing the label coming out of this idea of denial that's the only issue. That's kind of misleading. And of course, owning that alcoholic identity might be very threatening and put someone off, whereas maybe it's a bit of a gradual process. And I suppose, you know, my instinct would be that many people kind of step tentatively into recovery networks or AA, and then they realize it's a safe or very welcoming space, or they try some different meetings, and throughout that process they become more safe, and then understand it's a way of alleviating shame and getting social support or finding their meanings.
Yeah, certainly. And if you're looking at it from a 12-step perspective, the admission and acceptance of the alcoholic identity, that's seen as simply the first step. So that's, you've got a long way to go still if you're working a 12-step program. But equally, there are problems with, because I think
yes,
you're really onto something when you, so admission on the one hand of kind of that there is a problem, but that label alcoholic can be a massive barrier that actually prevents people from acknowledging that there is a problem. So
It's a high threshold, and I think going back to the stigma point is that people know that once you have that alcoholic identity, however that might make you feel, you know that in the eyes of society you're going to be labelled and cast and judged as other. And I think that's why stigma is so important. The threat to be placed into the outgroup by society is so potentially harmful and damaging. And of course, that's why it's anonymous to try and protect people from that. But, you know, it's hard in a very alcohol saturated society to, I suppose, always maintain that anonymity if that's going to be the choice. So I think, yeah, you know, the benefits are undeniable for people who engage in it, that many of them will find a life-changing recovery. But that uncertainty or apprehension is very normal, in the sense of the huge kind of complexities and implications for other people who are drinkers or heavy drinkers that exist in the wider society, how they'll respond to that.
Yeah, you're right. I think there is a kind of othering and out grouping of people, but there is also strength in that, in the sense that, you know, sometimes people will talk about how in Alcoholics Anonymous, people understand each other in a way that people in the outside world can't. Mm. And there is a kind of social identity strength in that, you know, regardless of whether it's actually true or not. You know, that sense of it's us against the rest of the world actually can be a very powerful motivator. So that othering does have a kind of another side to it.
So, yeah, again, even in some of the literature, again, taking a sort of more academic perspective, you know, that is recognised, I think, in amongst stigmatised groups, that there is an added psychological resource by their solidarity together in, exactly as you say, knowing that they need to club together to kind of face the threats and judgment of the bigger social in-group. So that's really important, yeah.
You mentioned anonymity there. And of course, that's a controversial idea that also has spiritual roots or could be interpreted in spiritual terms. So it's controversial because of the problem that it has led to there being, you know, a lack of visible recovery within communities. Mm. I think many outsiders think that this is driven by shame and it's, you know, having alcohol problems is a terrible secret or whatever. But in fact, within AA, anonymity is seen as a spiritual principle. And again, it's about humility. It's saying, you know, I'm not going to go out into the outside world and trumpet about my achievements with my recovery, because the recovery is not my work. It's the work of a higher power. Or, you know, I'm not going to trumpet my recovery out there, because if something were to happen and I were to, you know, start drinking again, then I potentially bring the fellowship and the 12 steps into disrepute. So, you know, there's a kind of sense of humility and responsibility embedded into that anonymity context. And I think the perception from the outside world that it's all about secrecy and shame is unfortunate, really. I think that's a misunderstanding of the concept.
That's really super interesting. I mean, I've listened to a few podcasts with Russell Brand, and I think he really tries to, you know, he kind of struggles with that, if my understanding is kind of right, that he's this very influential worldwide celebrity, essentially. And he's obviously, you know, he's an incredibly insightful, intelligent person, and with so many interesting ideas, of course, a lot of which I might not agree with necessarily. But I think he really talks about in some of his podcasts that reason why he talks about this comes with maybe a cost, that it's almost that he always tries to separate the fact that he should, you know, he's not trying to do this as part of feeding his own ego, but it's about sharing his experience. And I think that's really powerful in many ways, because certainly in terms of stigma, that I think hearing humanizing narratives, you know, understanding that addiction problems are ultimately about people. And I think that's why the sort of spirituality question really appeals to me, is that I do see addiction, despite all the social psychology or behaviorism, as ultimately a problem of living, that life is difficult and challenging and stressful as sentient beings, and addiction is almost a normal mechanism or response to that in many ways. So I think the humanizing narratives are really important in that. But as you say, yeah, it's really important not to typecast the anonymity in terms of shame or protecting people, but rather there's something a bit deeper to that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a dilemma for many people in recovery about, you know, how much to talk about it, how much to own it in the public space. You know, there are private spaces and public spaces, and it's quite tricky, I think, to know. And it's, you know, interesting observing people interpreting these concepts very differently from each other. But the visible recovery movement is a growing movement, and I think that's a very good thing. I think there are risks associated with that, you know, that people are at risk of kind of ending up on ego trips about it. But in general, the more stories of recovery that can be told, the greater diversity of recovery experience that we hear about within culture, that's a good thing. I mean, there's a kind of meta-narrative of recovery that things were awful, I did this and things got better, which has some value. But the problem is people's stories are always far more complicated than that. And I think, you know, there needs to be more and more diverse recovery stories available within culture generally to open up space for people who the 12-step program is not attractive to some people. So what are they going to do? You know, what's their recovery story going to be? And there are lots of other options available to people, lots of other ways of talking about these processes.
Totally. And that's partly the aim of the show, but also why the Adrian Charles story is so interesting, because on the first episode we did with him, he says he's cut down his drinking and obviously, you know, he says that people come up to him and they can't compute this idea of moderation. They don't understand what he's doing as a form of recovery. So even the word recovery itself is complicated, isn't it? Because it sort of prompts stereotypes and certain ideas of things, particularly abstinence and meetings and those kind of things. But yeah, I really agree that we need narratives that diversify the understanding of recovery in a much broader and individualized way, and perhaps spiritual as well.
Yeah, the term floating signifier is a good one with these terms like spirituality and recovery. They tend to mean whatever the speaker wants them to mean. There's not a shared kind of firm understanding of what these terms mean, and they're deployed in ways that, you know, can cause all kinds of difficulties, really. You say, oh, this is recovery and this isn't. Well, what that tells us is what you think recovery is, not whether this is recovery or it isn't, because there aren't shared standard ideas of what these things mean. But what I think that means that we all need to talk to each other a lot more than we do, and be less defensive about particular approaches, and to look for the similarities across different approaches. There's a kind of idea of very strong in the States that you can get sober through AA, or you could get sober in a rational way. And that, I think, is a false binary between, different approaches that actually have an awful lot in common, and they're rich cultural resources, and there should be lots of them, you know, so that people can find the ways that suit themselves and speak to their own experience of, you know, their difficulty with substances or whatever it is, and their own worldviews. You know, you can't make people believe certain things. You know, you can't make people believe anything. You know, people either resonate with certain ideas or they don't. So there has to be kind of vast array of different ways of talking about this process.
Yeah, I really agree. I think there's some really important points in that. And again, it goes back to that idea of sharing stories and humanizing narratives that enable people to, you know, empathize in some way and allow people to find their own ways of making sense or kind of recovery in inverted commas. And I think within the context of perhaps AA meetings, that's a big part of it, isn't it? That people are encouraged, are they not, to find what they identify and what other people say and be sort of compassionate and understanding. And that perhaps in many ways is a key strength of not only AA, but, you know, it's a philosophy that should run throughout any professional or informal recovery program, isn't it? That understanding and space for that person to make sense of it in their own way.
Yes, absolutely. And being non-judgmental and having a space where you can hear lots of different voices, I think is essential. And you know, that's my research on AA in the UK shows me that for the most part, there are some exceptions, but for the most part, that is the case. You know, there are diverse voices. There isn't the kind of schismatic issues that run through the situation in the US, for example, where, you know, AA tends to be expressed in ways that are much more obviously associated with Protestant Christianity. And therefore that, because that alienates some people, there's growth of the atheist or agnostic free thinker style of AA. And that's good because that creates diversity. But in the UK, we're seeing much less of that. There are atheist meetings in the UK, but they're not in anything like the same numbers. And I think that's because atheists in AA are welcomed and as part of the mainstream. So there isn't that need for schism. You know, it's quite acceptable to have a concept of a higher power that is simply the group. There's no requirement to have any kind of theological or metaphysical idea of what a higher power is. Although, of course, many people do have those ideas.
That's super interesting as well. And that, you know, that's one way in which people are supported or encouraged or allowed to make sense of it in their own way. And I suppose that relates to the way in which people might have described the idea of alcohol problems or alcoholism as a disease in the folk sense, that, you know, these are kind of more metaphors or maybe, as you say, floating signifiers, that it's not a dogmatic thing of you must do it in this way, that's certainly in most cases it would be more a real encouragement of people being allowed to make sense of it in ways that make sense to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you've looked quite a bit now at the idea of Buddhism as a form of spirituality or recovery, because there's quite a few groups or Buddhist-based recovery organisations. Could you talk about Buddhism and spirituality as a recovery process or movement?
Yeah, I think this is something that's a really interesting kind of development in the recovery field. So mindfulness is widely used as a kind of recovery technique in all kinds of sort of treatment settings that wouldn't consider themselves spiritual in any way. But of course, mindfulness has a long history in Buddhism. But there are also other explicitly Buddhist forms of recovery. So there are Buddhist interpretations of the 12 steps, for instance. So Kevin Griffin, an American writer, who his experience was 12 step initially, but he was a Buddhist and he thought about higher power in very Buddhist terms.
So what would that be?
Yeah, higher power is the teachings, the Dharma in Buddhism. So the teachings or the truth about the way things are, or the idea of karma, that, you know, you reap what you sow, one thing leads to another, and kind of understanding that as the nature of reality is a way of understanding addiction. You know, if you act in this way, there will be consequences for you and others. So he uses those ideas as higher power, and he interprets the 12 steps. So he, you know, he's a strongly kind of 12-step influenced thinker, but he interprets those through his Buddhist practice, basically. But then there are other forms of Buddhist recovery that don't refer to the 12 steps. So there's an organization called Recovery Dharma, which takes the idea of meetings and mutual aid. So there are Recovery Dharma meetings all over the world. There's some in the UK, and they use Buddhist teachings. Key in the Buddhist worldview is the idea of suffering and the idea of attachment and craving, and how attachment and craving lead to suffering, and kind of analysing that process in the context of first person experience of addiction, and kind of supportively sharing about that in meetings and talking about that. So Recovery Dharma meetings function very similarly, actually, to AA meetings, but they don't use the 12 steps. They don't have a concept of higher power, unlike Kevin Griffin, but they're becoming increasingly popular. There's also another Buddhist approach where a vow is taken. So vows are very kind of powerful ideas in Buddhism. There's an idea of the vow made by a bodhisattva that, you know, they will become awakened and help others to become awakened. So in this other form of Buddhist recovery, popularized by the teacher Vince Cullen, he talks about making a vow not to take intoxicants. So there are five precepts in Buddhism, kind of practiced all over the Buddhist world. And the fifth of those precepts is to avoid intoxicants which cloud the mind and lead to carelessness or heedlessness. So it's a kind of mindfulness-based understanding kind of the consequences of taking substances that cloud the mind. So Vince teaches about the power of making a vow to avoid those substances. So his approach is a once and for all vow, whereas Kevin Griffin's, which is much more aligned with the 12-step world, is much more that day at a time approach that you find in AA. So there's a whole variety of different Buddhist ways of engaging in addiction recovery. It's not one, what is the Buddhist way? There are lots of different Buddhist approaches to this, and they're becoming, you know, much more well known. There's another type called the 8-step approach, created by two members of the Buddhist group Tri Ratna. So a black British woman called Vimala Sara Mason John and a psychiatrist called Paramabandhu Groves. So the 8-step program, which obviously draws on the idea of a step approach to recovery, but it's thinking much more in terms of mindfulness as a way of thinking about addiction, as a way of interrogating experience and developing a kind of more wholesome way of living.
As you were talking there, I kept thinking about the ways in which these Buddhist derived ideas or applications have been, I think in your paper reviewing all of this, it's, what's it called, a neoliberal supplement or something. The idea is it that, you know, that these things are being taken from Buddhism and used in ways in which presents a lot of kind of difficult questions. I mean, I like the term mindful drinking because I think it's a good way of encouraging people to think about what's going on when they drink, what's the physiological reactions and how does that affect their, you know, psychological state. But yeah, it's a contradiction in terms in some ways when you're talking about like the vows around no intoxicating substances. You know, the idea of mindful drinking is paradoxical in that sense, surely.
So, you know, Buddhism is very diverse in the kind of range of possible responses that you could have. It's interesting you should raise that about neoliberalism. So in the academic literature, there's a kind of strong critique of spirituality that I find really powerful and interesting and always important to consider, because we've been talking about spirituality as almost as if it's an unambiguously good thing. And I think it's worth kind of reflecting on that. So, you know, some of the critiques of spirituality are that we live in this kind of capitalist rat race and spiritual techniques are ways of enabling us to deal with the negative effects of that, enabling us to cope, but therefore keeping that whole capitalist rat race thing going rather than setting up a critique of it. So I think when you're talking about spirituality, the importance of acceptance and the importance of forgiveness, and these are really important concepts, but I think we need to remember that they have a kind of shadow side as well. So if we accept absolutely everything, then we don't actually make changes as individuals and at a social level that need to be made. So we never address social injustice or the kinds of injustices that lead to addiction. You know, we know that addiction is far more prevalent in communities that are disenfranchised, that are poor, that don't have access to resources. So if we say, oh, well, acceptance is the key to everything, we're never going to address those issues. So that critique of spirituality as being potentially at least a kind of facilitator of neoliberalism is a really important critique. And there's also a concept called spiritual bypassing, which I think it needs to be heard more really in the literature, that it is possible to kind of see spirituality just as a kind of self-soothing thing. And of course, self-soothing is important and self-care is important. But if that's all it is, it can become very self-serving and it becomes all about the self feeling okay rather than having the courage to make the changes in life that either as an individual you might want to do or at a social level. You know, people pat themselves on the back for being spiritual. I think that is potentially problematic, actually.
Yeah, I think that's really thought-provoking. And it just reminds me of some of these groups of philosophies or whatever are quite focused on addressing that, aren't they, in terms of, you know, what can you do for others rather than yourself?
Yeah, so the 12-step program for instance, is a very kind of hardcore moral discipline. So obviously not everybody in AA or the other 12-step fellowships decide that they want to work the 12 steps. They're free to or not as they choose. But if they do choose that route, then it is a very challenging process to look at, you know, one's past, to consider the wrongs that have been done to others, to become committed to change, to actually make amends where that is possible to do so. And I mean, members of AA will talk about this as a spiritual thing, that amends may take a lifetime, amends may be impossible to completely make. But this is actually about action in the outside world. It's not simply sitting one-to-one with a counsellor and reflecting, beneficial though that is, of course. This is about kind of living in a different way. Many people might hear that and think, wow, that sounds really kind of moralistic. But in fact, the people who work the program will say that the power of doing that has enabled them to come out of shame, to become comfortable in their own skin, to get some self-respect back that has been lost in the process of addiction, to become useful in society, to actually see the reality of all other people that they may have harmed, to become accountable for that, to live differently. And then, so those are really to do with steps 4 to 9. And then steps 10, 11 and 12 are about kind of the ongoing effort to reach out to other people who are still suffering and to help. So that to me is not a kind of neoliberal, you know, let's all get our stress relief and you know, feel better after a bit of meditation. It's something, you know, kind of far more outward looking than that. But in saying that, I don't want to belittle stress relief and self-soothing and all of those kinds of practices, self-care, because those are absolutely crucial if you are going to do anything else. People who experience addiction report how difficult it is to relax, to sleep, you know, all of those things, and kind of learning new techniques to do those things is an absolutely crucial part of recovery, and those techniques are wonderful at delivering that. It's just, I think it's problematic if it stops there.
I think that's really nicely put, in that we want people to find their way out of addiction or find recovery in whatever way works for them, and for that to reach as many people as possible, even if it might look or sound completely different to that. But at the same time, exactly as you said, we have to think about what are the structural, what are the wider drivers and determinants of that. And we absolutely know that the increasing inequality, this kind of focus on mindless consumerism and trying to make yourself feel better in the moment that's being kind of fed from us at a much more meta level is working against us in terms of driving addiction. And that's, I think, Bruce Alexander and lots of kind of authors who talk about that. So I think that's been fantastic. So much food for thought for me particularly, and we'll leave it there.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Alcohol Problem Podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram @AlcoholPodcast, so please feel free to follow us or get in touch there.